Hello and welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is a horny artist who may be a bit unfaithful. His name's Joel.
I mean, that's just actually the truth here. My name, yes, Joel. Yeah, my name is Joel, man.
That's all you got.
That's all I got. I mean, what am I supposed to say?
Yeah, it's nothing too over the top with this movie, to really.
No. You just based a character exactly on who I am, which is a full of himself jackass.
Yeah, but this episode will be on the 82. This is the special episode for June, but kind of due to life and other things got pushed back. So who cares? It'll be an extra episode for July. But yeah, the special episode is on Losing Ground, the 1982 Kathleen Collins film. Her only full-length feature film that she got to make, and it had no official release. I think it played at some film festivals, but no theatrical release until, I believe it played in some New York theaters, but our guests can get into that. We have Intume Gant from the...
Hey.
So, how are you?
How y'all doing? No. I'm good. Sorry, I can let you continue the intro.
No. You can start talking now.
Okay, cool. Hey, how's everybody doing?
All right.
Yeah, I'm devastated by my professor wife, you know, possibly leaving me after being terrible to her. I just don't understand.
I mean, you gotta be careful with bookworms, man.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
They have emotions also. Remember that.
Yes, so Joel, had you ever heard this movie before I told you we were doing an episode on it?
Oh, no. I hadn't heard a single thing about it.
Oh.
And that's not surprising based on the information I read about it. You know, it doesn't... I mean, like you said, no wide release, kind of up in obscurity until Millstone picked it up to restore it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it got, more widely seen more recently, but it's an obscure gem, to say the least.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw it. It was Wiz. I had never heard of it at all. I never even heard of Kathleen Collins until about... I'm going to say it was 2016, but it could be a 2015. It played at Lincoln Center. They basically did a revival of it after Milestone had restored it. And, you know, it was interesting because then, like, I saw a couple of, like, IndieWire, back when Shadow and Act was still kind of going in its older form with IndieWire. They said, see this movie, this lost film. And the reason I think I initially also got into it because I heard Bill Gunn was acting in it and Dwayne Jones. So I was just like, oh, that's amazing. A movie with Bill Gunn in it. I got to go see it. I'm a big Bill Gunn fan. And I went to see it while I was playing. I went with like three or four of my friends and we just, you know, had a great time. And then after that, I was just so astonished to hear, you know, no one had ever seen it. Had aside like one screening and then I played some and it won some award in a festival in Portugal.
Yeah, it's, you know? I think I first heard of it on the podcast, The Flophouse. One of the hosts recommended it in one episode and mentioned Dwayne Jones. I think it was Elliot. This feels like an Elliot movie.
Well, he's usually the one who recommends something with some sort of class, not that garbage the rest of them watch.
Like a castle freak.
Yeah.
So like Elliot kind of mentioned it, and I was like, oh, that sounds like an interesting movie, and I think it was on Filmstruck, maybe?
It was, for a bit.
Yeah, and that's when, but by the time I got onto watching it, it was off there, so I ordered a DVD because I figured at least own it, like, you know, it's just, why not buy it? I like getting DVDs of things that are not common, because if it's not common, then I feel like it's kind of worth owning. I don't know, that's a weird mix for me, but
no, I understand, like, especially if it disappears, you know, people think of streaming as covering everything, but like if it if it goes off of streaming or the whoever owns the property, you know, no longer wants to make it available, then if you don't have a physical copy or know somebody who does, it just might as well not exist nowadays.
No, that's for real. Like, I do that with films that, like, I just know is going to be hard to locate. So I was like, I ended up doing that with Losing Ground. The minute I saw that it had a Blu-ray, I just bought it. I think I even pre-ordered it because, like, my initial fear is, you know, it'll be hot for, like, 3 or 4 years, and then it'll be forgotten, and then you can't get the Blu-ray anymore. You can't get the DVD anymore. So let me cop it now while it's, you know, affordable and available.
Oh, yeah. And so when I finally bought it and watched it, I was like, oh, this is not a lost masterpiece. I wouldn't say it's necessarily like a perfect by any stretch, but it definitely is a striking, a very, very well made first film, even though she did make The Cruz Brothers before, which I haven't watched that on the 2-disc set yet. But yeah, the fact she only got to make 2 movies is a real. It's a real shame because there's genuine talent here. Just,
yeah,
you know, like with Daughters of the Dust episode, we kind of were like, yeah, this is a really striking, you know, feature film. This she never, well, actually, Julie Dash is making another feature now, but you know, she got relegated to TV movies where, yeah. Kevin Collins kind of, I guess, went back to being a professor.
She was also a writer. Because I, you know, so after like Kathleen Collins, like after I saw the film, I got immediately interested in her, and then I think about a year later or a year and a half later, they released a collection of her short stories, and I bought those, and it actually sat on my shelf for like a year, but last summer I read them, and oh man, she was a really, really good writer. She's a really interesting short story writer, like just a very, they're actually a lot like her films, the two film, I've seen both of her films. Mm-hmm. Her stories, the way they kind of develop in this kind of loose narrative, kind of this kind of subjective emotional experience of a person, you know, that's kind of how her stories, but also the kind of like multiple perspectives sometimes. Her stories are really good. They're actually quite cinematic. So you could see in her stories, like, oh, I could see how she was able to take her writing abilities into becoming a filmmaker.
I watched some of the special features, and I think it was the interview she did with Indiana University. She mentioned she was one of the few black and one of the few female editors in New York City in the 70s.
Right.
And so she was around filmmakers, and she knew at least the editing part of filmmaking, and she fell in love with that, like the more technical side of it. And I think she became a film professor around that time, because that's when American universities started to teach film. And she, I think, took film classes in when she was in France before that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, but like for like she's I don't know how she met Bill Gunn, but she and him were friends, and that's pretty much how he got into the movie. And I think she also knew Dwayne Jones through Bill Gunn, and I think like Sarette Scott was also a friend. Like, it's mostly just her friends that were in the acting world.
Well, you know, I suspect, and this is completely me basing it, this off of my own kind of like an inference, you know, Bill Gunn kind of worked with this kind of like Manhattan, like Upper West Side kind of black community, which I also know Kathleen Collins lived up there. So I feel like there was like a big, or not even a big, a small kind of conglomerate of people that if they had these common interests, it was going to be impossible for them not to meet, you know?
Yeah.
And then, and like Dwayne Jones was in Ganja and Hess, you know? So it's like, okay, you know, you can, I'd like to imagine they had this kind of community, you know. I might be like projecting more, but it feels like there was at least for a short while, a short kind of small friendship between them all. Because, like, when I watched Personal Problems by Bill Gunn, it reminded me in little ways, the tones of the kind of people, it reminded me of Losing Ground.
Oh, yeah, Personal Problems does feel like this a bit. And maybe we'll do an episode on that. I think you have to get the Blu-ray now to see it.
It might be on Canopy, but I'm not sure if it's still on Canopy. But I don't know. I know people are losing access to Canopy now, so that seems to be a controversy now. So yeah, even if you might not be able to get access to it.
Yeah. But Personal Problems was Bill Gunn's other movie. Well, he had one before Conjuring Hess that has never had a real release, but I do agree with you on like the whole black artist community thing, because like it definitely feels similar to that and kind of akin to L.A. Rebellion. I haven't seen too much L.A. Rebellion stuff, but maybe like an East Coast version. But L.A. Rebellion seemed to have more like stuff come out.
Yeah, there definitely was a real kind of pronounced, movement. I went to a screening. I went to one of the opening screenings of Personal Problems, the re-release. And, many of the people who worked on it were there. And I kind of wish I would have asked about Kathleen Collins when I was there. Like, was she around? Was it something that were y'all all connected? I should have got Ishmael Reed was there. I should have asked more, but I didn't.
Oh, yeah. He's been in news recently.
Oh, yes, he has. My man.
Yeah, that for weird reasons. But that's not the topic for today.
Right.
But, Joel, what did you think of Losing Ground overall? Like, what's your like gut impressions?
I think it's a really interesting movie. I think that the way the plot lays out is kind of not what I was expecting. I hate saxophone. this movie is laden with saxophone, that's and I understand that's my problem.
Yes.
It's just something people did. But it doesn't, luckily I don't think it interfered with me enjoying the movie.
You might hate Personal Problems. Like, there's saxophone in that too.
Oh, there's a whole sequence at the end of saxophone.
I mean, Spike Lee's peppers his stuff with saxophone all the time too, so
this is true.
I'm just in trouble in general. I think it's incredibly well made, and the fact that it was made like as quickly as they could because of how much money they, the budget and everything like that, it's kind of astonishing. Like it is just a solid movie. I get like 7 out of 10 for me. Which on my scale means yeah, I totally watch that again, and probably will. I think the fact that the playing around with the race in the movie only comes in a little bit, like it's not like the main driver or anything like that. It's really just about the relationship of these two individuals, and they're both characterized and spelled out so well by what happens in the plot that I feel like I knew them and I knew what was going to be going on with them.
Yeah, like race does come into it, but it's not like how Spike deals with race. It's definitely more like it's just another layer, but the real core of it is their failing marriage.
Yeah, and it's like that's what I'm saying. The problems that occur in their relationship is not related to their race, and it's not necessarily related to their genders or anything like that either. The kind of things you might expect in a more cliched storyline, it felt realistic that way. Well, I did think it was, I mean, it had some funny things, both of those people going up and being like, after his class, you're so, or after her classes, you're so lively. And your husband must be very happy or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, but her husband complains about how unlively she is. It's like, oh man, it's like he doesn't really know her, I guess. But yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
But when it was filmed, like most of the cast and crew lived with them in their house with Colleen and her husband. at the time. And there's an interview on the disc with, I think they had two kids, but their daughter, Nina, who is also a writer. And it's a really this interesting interview going over, talking about this, what it was like to grow up around it. And the shoot was very stressful. It's a small indie movie, so of course it would be, you know, a bit stressful and kind of like you have to get everything right because you don't have much money. But Nina was 12 at the time, so to her it was like, oh, this is like fun. This is, you know, mom's making a movie. And she says something that I didn't know. She mentions that Bill Gunn and Sam Wayman were partners, which I knew Bill, you know, was at least with Men and Women, but I didn't know he and Sam were ever together.
I didn't know that either.
She says she says partners, so I.
Oh wow,
I
interesting.
I guess that's what she meant, but like they would Sam, Bill, and Kathleen would all like smoke weed together and hang out at each other's houses, which sounds like fun time.
Oh man, those three in a room together feels incredible.
And she said, like Kathleen, as a mom, was loving, but she could be kind of cold and like very, very business focused, and like like she had a sign on her door to her office, like "Do not disturb," basically for up until like one in the afternoon. And it wasn't like she would yell and scream if she was disturbed, but definitely you would notice she'd be extremely annoyed to be bothered. So like they're like you know, she is kind of a complex person. She was a loving mother, but at the same time she you know, had to work and write and do, you know, to pay the bills and everything.
Yeah.
And she died around the same time as Bill and Dwayne Jones, unfortunately.
Which is like, if you when you wrap your head around it, it's so crazy.
I think it's like, you know, it's like almost a year, like within 1 year, all three of them passed.
Is this like a The Conqueror situation where everybody on set got cancer or something? I mean, that's kind of weird.
Kathleen had breast cancer. Bill,
A brain. He died of like a brain aneurysm, and encephalitis. Mm-hmm. He died from.
And
I don't know how Dwayne Jones died.
I thought it was a heart attack.
At the end of his life, he was living in, I think, Long Island, and he hated when people approach him about Night of the Living Dead. I think he was embarrassed over it or annoyed that that's the only thing people talked about.
Well, what movie can I approach him about?
Well, Gondren has almost had no release to it, and he was in Break-In, or he was in like some kind of Golden Globe.
He's in Beat Street.
Beat Street, that's it. But like besides that, like his movies weren't easily seen or famous, so I don't know, maybe cause I really don't know why he felt that way about Night of the Living Dead.
Maybe he wanted to be known for his stage stuff. It says he died of cardiopulmonary arrest, which is basically heart failure. So
The Losing Ground, I should mention, is autobiographical to Kathleen's marriage, and Kathleen's dad, not Kathleen, Nina's dad, Kathleen's ex-husband, was white, not light-skinned, which I don't think informs the movie at all, but it is a little extra detail.
It informs a lot of her short stories. Like, her short stories do a little... I mean, the title of her book is Whatever Happened to Interracial Love. That's, like, the title of her short story book. And she definitely writes a lot about not just, like, interracial relationships, but, like, intercultural relationships, which I think is something that is in Losing Ground also, and, with, like, the Puerto Rican...
And the Cruz Brothers.
She does a lot. So, like, She has one great short story about like a guy who was from the African continent and her, and like the and this woman from a black, this black American woman and their relationship and how they couldn't connect based on, you know, nationality. So she seems to be really interested in that, in these kind of separations and how people can find common grounds and where they don't also.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. I mean, they kind of touch on it in this one. I feel like it's almost a less of a race thing and more of a class thing when it comes to the conflict in this one, because, you know, Bill Gunn's character wants to be out there with the people, and he's like, oh, it's like walking in a dream. And his mentor is, you know, he's jealous of the fact that he didn't have any formal learning, and so he hasn't been able to recreate what his mentor has been able to do, because he can't help but be guided by what he learned in school. And, you know, when they go to, he's like, we're gonna rent a house and we'll be right there in the neighborhood. It's like, no, you got this like mansion up on a hill kind of thing.
You're super separate. Yeah, it's interesting. I watched it again. So this is when I preparing for this, I watched it a second time. I watched it for a third time. I hadn't seen it since I bought the Blu-ray a couple of years ago. And it was interesting, like this, when Bill Gunn is kind of walking through the town, I felt so uncomfortable. And I thought it was really interesting to see this kind of like black man being looking at these exotic Puerto Rican people. And I thought it was interesting to put him in that position. And these are typically positions you see like white people when they go into areas, you know. And, mm-hmm. you know, the fact that he saw these like Puerto Rican people were like full of life and, you know, in the in the field and stuff like that. And I was just kind of like, he's having this weird reaction, I think, to his bourgeois lifestyle. And he wants to get back with the people. And I thought that was a very interesting comment. Knowing, I think, Kathleen Collins, who probably dealt in a lot of bourgeois circles herself, probably wondered, and probably on her own level, but also like observed other people who constantly had conflicts with their kind of bourgeois lifestyle in the Upper West Side and places like that in New York.
Hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I also took him, Bill Gunn, walking through the streets as like him just like looking for the next woman to sleep with.
Oh, totally.
Like once he mentions, we can go to the town where all the Puerto Rican women are. It's like, and she immediately knows, like, oh, I know why he wants to go there.
Right, and now it's Puerto Ricans this week.
And it's both like kind of a funny moment, like after seeing it the first time, and also kind of like, oh, this is really sad, and shows like exactly what their marriage is like.
Yeah, totally, man. Like it's. It's an interesting picture in the sense of like they're all very complicated, and that's why I really liked the film, because like kind of what you were saying about like the saxophones, Joelle, like I can't front, like there are things about this movie that I think I would normally not like.
Oh yeah,
like,
yeah.
There's like little like bells, and I remember when I went and saw it, I was kind of like, man, I don't know if I'm gonna like this. Let me see it. And by the end of it, I was really delighted. And also, like, really, it hit home. I think also because I'm from, you know, transparency. I mean, I'm from New York. And my parents are kind of from that area. They were, like, they're younger than Kathleen Collins and those people. But, like, they hung out in that. So it actually reminded me of things mm-hmm. that, like, I don't see anymore. It reminded me when I was a kid and, like, the adults that my parents would be around. But also... the fact that they had all this duality and these different kind of levels to them, it made the picture really work for me, because those things that I normally would be kind of annoyed at were actually expressions of where they are at that time and expressions of the time. So it felt authentic, and it didn't bother me. I'm like, this is really, you know, how they view the world and how they go with the world. So I was really into it, and I watched it again, you know, and I was like, you know what, man, I really like this picture, that there are things about it that normally would not work for me. And it surprisingly is really working for me. And I'm totally into it, but I think 'cause it's not contrived and it's not forced. It's just very much there. It's multidimensional, has a lot of levels. And I was just, you know, I feel it.
Like, do you guys want to go through, like, character by character? Because there's not exactly a plot. It's just kind of incidences, and you know, it's not exactly.
We could do characters. I'm down with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I guess. Do you want Bill Gunn first or Surratt?
Let's do Surratt first.
Yeah.
So, like, superficially, she kind of reminds me of, I always forget her name, from Blackish, the mom who's a daughter, Diana Ross's daughter.
Oh, Tracy Ellis Ross.
Yeah, kind of reminds me of her a little bit. But, like, I like that this movie opens with Surratt Scott as Sarah opening as a philosophy professor at a college.
Yeah.
And just seeing a black woman as a philosophy professor in a college was, like, to me, the first time I saw this earlier this year was like, holy shit, I don't think I've ever seen that in a movie.
Yeah. And it's so not overly put on. Like, it's not like, sometimes when they'll do that, they'll make them very big and, like, and she's just kind of a lady. She's a little tight. And, you know, and I don't know, I'm thinking for a better word, bookish and doesn't have a lot of, like, spunk, you know? And it's, like, it's cool to see a person who's kind of, like, bucking the trend of black, massive amounts of energy. She's just kind of there and, you know, a little prudish and just very, very cool, you know, and very, very smart. And it's, I really enjoyed that. I was like, this is a character I've never seen before. You know, even in her nuances and how she maneuvers.
Mm. You get the feeling that she is doing the professorial part because she knows her, you know, this is her, what she studies all the time. And she's constantly right. working on these ideas and searching for new ways to think about things. And it's kind of like, well, I make money this way so I can continue and have an excuse to do my learning. Right. And when you get a pan over the class, instead of like everybody being rapt or everybody being bored, you get the probably the appropriate mix of college student reactions, which is some people are totally into it and some people are just, you know, can't follow what she's saying. And I think that also is a realistic depiction that I appreciate.
Yeah,
it took me
as a college professor for sure. I work in colleges and I see those faces.
it took me back to when I was at the first college I went to, not the one I graduated from, but the first I went to, and taking a philosophy class and being one of the people who's kind of zoned out, like I don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
Oh man, yeah, there's that one shot with the guy with the headphones and he's just checked out. Homie's like listening to his music and he's just kind of moving. I'm like, oh man. I know there's some kids in like some like lecture classes with earbuds now that just be rocking out listening to nothing.
Oh yeah. You can't stop them.
Oh hell no, especially now, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, I also like that you get to see the film student. You get a little hint of him. Because he's wearing the lens on his eye, like a monocle.
Yeah, right, I was like, why is this guy wearing a monocle? But okay, that's his quirk. He's the character in the movie that didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's fine; like he didn't destroy the movie or anything. But he's you know, he's the jokey joke character.
Yeah,
he's very excited for life, and he's kind of a mockery of. Probably the director making fun of herself, right? But it's the jokes fall flat, and it's okay.
Yeah,
he's a college student.
Yeah, but and like all as mentioned earlier, but like the like every time a student someone would mention her husband, she'd kind of not be upset or anything, but it's kind of like she'd have this initial reaction of like. Why don't you talk about my husband? Like I feel like she wants to. It's kind of like she sees it as they're defying her only through her husband, or it was like I don't know where I'm going for this.
Yeah, that was weird.
Well, they also say to her like, "Your husband, I bet your husband appreciates you," And then, you know, it's weird because it's like he clearly doesn't appreciate her. You know, he has a, he's constantly poking at her. When we get to Bill Gunn's character, we can talk about it more further. But, like, it's this weird irony. It's like, not only are they, like, weirdly asking her about her husband, but then, like, saying the very thing that he doesn't do, which almost makes you wonder, like, do they know that she's in an unhappy marriage or a marriage that has some turbulence? It's just weird. But it's, you know, I think it's kind of speaking to kind of like the weird metaphysical nature of existence in a weird, where like things are just kind of strange and you have strange happenings, you know, because that's kind of how it is in the movie. Like the movie she ends up doing with the college student kind of strangely mirrors her life, you know, there's all these weird mirrors.
And like her whole, like I'll be honest, her like her speech in the beginning with the class, her lecture, I try to take notes on it. I'm trying to like understand it, but like I even rewound it a couple times. I find it hard to follow, and I'm not quite sure how it fits into the movie. I'm sure it does. Like again, coming from someone who only has an associate's degree and has never taken a philosophy class, well, passed one. So, like, I don't know. It kind of takes me out of the movie a little bit, but, I don't know. Like, does her, like, does what she's talking about, does that tie into her, like, her paper on religious ecstasy?
I don't know. Is she talking about Janae in that one? I can't remember. I'm not trying to remember. Who was she talking about?
I think
we talking about during the class?
Yeah.
During the class, yeah. Was she talking about Janae in that point?
I think I can't remember. That's when the...
I don't know if... You know, sorry.
When the first student, the first person who brings up her husband, he brings up, oh, I saw the book on Janae or something like that.
Right. Now, I don't think we were meant to follow what she was saying in the beginning. I think it was supposed to be purposely obtuse in your, you know, because, you know, advanced college class or whatever.
Yeah. Which kind of, I guess, also, you know, seeps into the whole overall thing where, like, the student, maybe making us feel like the student's like, oof, okay, what is she talking about?
Yeah. Yeah, my real education there, because later when she's working on her own thing, yeah, like you were talking about the experience of ecstasy and the the roots, you know, religion wise or anything like that, and gets to the point where it's like, I actually want to know what this feels like. I don't want to just write about it and read about it. I want to, you know, the experience thing. That at that point I was like completely on board what she was talking about.
Yeah. I love that moment when she goes to the library in the spot, and she says, I'm looking for books, you know, research books. It's like, on what? Ecstatic experiences. I'm like, oh, yeah, they know where the ecstatic experience section is in the library. It's like such a randomly strange section of thoughts to go look for, which kind of like leads into like she's kind of like lives in her own head.
Yeah, and like you get this sense that she's only comfortable around other people like who are like professors or not say intellectuals, but like, you know, other people like cuz her husband, like cuz with Bill Gunn's character, his whole thing is like, I want to be with the people in the streets, and her, and she's like the opposite, or you know, she's like, would rather be with like the academics and the philosophers, and like she feels nearly more comfortable with like people of.
Well, I mean, it seems like that way too, but she also has put herself, like, as we see her character develop, we see that she's put herself into that package. And, you know, they talk about how her mother was an actress and like, oh, you're not really like your mother, but, you know, your mother's a certain way. At least this is coming from Bill Gunn, who's saying this stuff like that. But, you know, when she gets offered that that film role, it's like, well, this is a part of me that I've just, like, not even considered.
Yeah.
And it turns out to be something she actually does want. So, like, does she know what she wants? So all she knows is that, I mean, she's got Bill Gunn's character down for herself all the way. She knows she's not going to get cooperation from him. And any time either of them try to make nice, there's, like, these hidden jabs underneath. Like, you guys were talking about, like, Bill Gunn being the horny character in this movie before. Mm-hmm. And with her, it's not even a thing. Like, anytime it comes up to, like, how she's, you know, beautiful, like, oh, the light, it must be doing something to you. Like, he has to explain it. Like, it can't be just like, I'm attracted to my wife. It's like, oh, there's something special going on tonight. I don't know what it is, but anyways.
Yeah. Oh, that was such a cringy moment. And that's the thing about Bill Gunn's character in the movie. Like, you know, I find Bill Gunn very alluring as an actor. I'm always really into watching him. Mm-hmm. But he does so many cringy things in the movie. And you're just like, oh, bro, that's mean. Like, that's, and he doesn't yell at her or anything like that. He kind of does it under, like, the guise of, like, I don't know, not necessarily niceness, but a kind of cool vibe to it. But, like, dude, you just said that she looks good because of light. Like, that's messed up.
Yeah.
And when he's drunk, he has, like, the really horrible barb of, like, oh, I forgot you can't dance.
Oh, that scene is messed up, man.
Yeah.
That's really, like, yeah, it's funny because, like, when Dwayne Jones comes in and his eyes, when she brings in the other man to, like, their house, and he's, like, his eyes, and he's looking at Dwayne Jones, and they're popping out, and it's so hilarious, too, because I don't think he says anything in that scene. He just kind of looks at the guy, and I was like, damn. So when they go to the dance sequence, yeah, you can tell he just wants to embarrass her and use the other woman that he's with, you know, and I think it's really interesting that the film explores that, because, like, that's how relationships can be, these little subtle, you know, just toxicities, and she shows them.
Yeah
it's like it's a very uncomfortable movie with, like, their whole relationship, but it's also pretty watchable. It's not a grueling experience. It's not like Possession, which is like an intense movie about a failed marriage. This is like a cooler version. Not cooler as in like trendy, cooler as in like temperature wise. Like, it's not like it definitely is watchable.
Not the William H. Macy movie, The Cooler.
No.
You might be afraid to be triggered, like, if you've had bad relationships or stuff like that. And honestly, like, you can't help but see the kind of, in everyone's relationship, there's some little bit of contention, you know, a little bit of, like, you know, just the sharpest way to barb the person you're with, especially as you get closer to that person, you can know exactly what you would say that would hurt their feelings in a way. So you can see reflections in any relationship, but this doesn't have, like, a real big blowout moment. I guess the part towards the end, but he's doing something so heinous, like,
oh, yeah.
Like, I don't blame her for, you know, yelling at him. So, we're not having blowout fights. We're not, you know, there's no violence or anything like that. Like,
yeah, it's almost like microaggressions. And, like, it's the things that, like you said, that happen when you're with someone for, like, a certain amount of time. You know, they've been together, what, 10 years or something like that in the film, or like, you know, you just know how to, if you want to get on the person's nerves and jab at them, you know exactly what to do. So he knows it, and also I think he also knows that she'll take it, and I think almost he's probably maybe waiting for her to show some emotion. Maybe he's a little tired of it, of her little, like, there's a moment when she, like, takes little, like, verbal pot shots when he's painting her or drawing her, and he's kind of like, man, that's not you. Yeah. I think he wants her to, like, blow up, but she won't, and he's like, all right, well, then I'm gonna keep doing what I do.
Mm-hmm.
when it finally happens, that's why it's so shocking to him, like, well, oh I finally, wow, wait what I'm in trouble, wait we don't do this. Yeah.
I like her relationship with her mom, because, like, that's, like, her mom's the only person, I guess, Dwayne Jones, too, because, like, her mom can really, like, cut through her and cut through her, like, her cold, like, her cold veneer, even though, like, I think her mom, I don't write down my notes who said it, but someone does tell her, you have a noble, like, her face is noble, cold, and, analytical, and, like, with her mom, like, that kind of drops and she becomes more, I get like more quote unquote human.
Yeah, there's a way that you realize she couldn't kind of, what her facades wouldn't work with her mom. Mm. You know, it's your mom. it's your parent. They know who you are. You know, so the defenses, they're not going to work here.
And with her mom, like there's that one moment when like she realizes, you know, he found another woman. And she's like, "Oh, it's not the sex that bothers me." And her mom reacts like, "Yeah, we've been down this road before. Like, it's just so like treated matter of factly. Like, well, he's gonna cheat, and you know, there's nothing I can do." But then you know, she does. Like, I don't know.
And I think that's a really interesting way to look at relationships, because I think, you know, the melodramatic way is to, like you said before, is to, like, immediately make it, like, this big blow-up. You cheated on me! And, you know, some relationships, like, some people let certain things go, as long as you don't do certain types of behavior, right? So I guess for her, it was, like, putting, when she yells at him at the end, you know, it's like she says you're putting it in my face and you're sticking it out there, like, yeah. His literally his penis, but also his manliness. And you know, it's like, that's what I don't want you to do. She's like, I'll, you know, you have your things, and I honestly have figured out a way to deal with them. You know, and doesn't, I can actually live with this. It's actually livable, but that's just not livable. And I think that's very real with relationships. Like, you really talk to people, man, you find a lot of levels of relationships that people kind of accept that work for them, that maybe not work for you, or may not be popular in ideas.
Yeah, it tends to, I mean, as much as they were able to live with each other and exist with each other, it didn't seem like either one of them was happy, you know?
Right, this is true.
Like,
yeah.
This coexisting type thing, and like, when we first see them together, there's a bit of a celebration going on because Bill Gunn's got, you know, he's going to be featured in a museum, right, or something like that, or art show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's like, oh yeah, I finally made it. I made it, you know? And you think something happy is going to be going on, but he kind of destroys it right away because he's like, and I've been hanging out in this neighborhood and I'm going to go rent a house. It's like, oh, are there any libraries? I don't know. Like, well, is it a vacation for just you or yeah. What? Because
you could drive back down to the city, you know, a couple of days a week. He's just like, wait a minute. So I got to go back down to do my work. Okay, like, thank you.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
And he knows for her, it's not even just like a matter of like, this is the work she's doing, this is what she's passionate about. You know, the way he's passionate about painting and sketching and all that stuff like that, this is the thing that she works with. And that's, you think a man would a person would understand that their partner, this is important to them. And yeah, he just is not, he is so oblivious.
Yeah, he really, you know, he really defines that kind of self-absorbed artist in that sense of his experience, his reality is what's important, you know, why he's like that, I don't know if they ever really kind of narrow in on it. I don't think it's important so much, but it's he is a very self-absorbed person in that sense, and it's interesting to watch it, because usually a lot of times you also see it in films and it's like, it's really like big and heavy, and his is just kind of, it just kind of floats around. But in some ways it's actually more hurtful, because it almost like he just doesn't really care. He's like flippant. It's just like, oh, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever. And I'm like, wow, that's, that's like, that, for me, that would actually hurt even more. Like, a person who's like yelling and screaming, I know I'm just going to go. All right, you're too much. But this person who's kind of like casual, like, remember when he comes home after making the pictures, he says, I have a headache. He's like, he like never looks at her when he walks in. He's like putting up his pictures on the wall. And I was like, man, like this wall, this literal, not literal, this figurative wall he's putting up against her, that's just so abusive. But it's like so subtle, you know,
yeah,
to the point where he could almost go, she said, if she said something about it, why are you acting this way? He could go, you're being weird. I'm not doing anything.
Yeah.
It's so passive aggressive. It's like, and I think it's really brilliant as far as a, you know, it's where I think the brilliance of the film is in the acting and creating these kind of subtle relationship moments. And I think that's why I really like the film, I was saying, because of those kinds of subtleties that they get within the relationships that that feel, you could almost miss if you're not looking keenly.
Yep.
Yeah. And like adding to like the complexity of the relationship, like, I don't think it's ever explicitly said, but like I always get the feeling of she's the one making all the money and supporting him.
Yeah, totally. That's, I mean, that you could read that into the, like, oh, I finally made it thing, like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, totally, totally. I totally figured that. Like, college professor, like, does he even have a job? We don't hear that he's selling paintings, you know?
Yeah, like,
you know, he's paying the bills.
He sells at least one painting, and it's like, is that his first painting ever sold? Or, it's never exactly clear, but it's clear, like, you know, she has all the money, and he's just basically being a child the whole time.
Yeah, he is it. Thank you for saying that. When I watched it today, I was like, he's very childish. Even in his body language sometimes, there's a kind of a childishness to him.
Well, that scene you were talking about where he comes in and he's like, I've been walking around, I'm tired, and he's not even looking at her. Like, he has a whole child meltdown thing because she's like, I really want to talk about what you've done that's upset me. And he's like, can we just go eat first? I am starving. Like,
he said, I had two espressos. I need to eat. It's
you
so
say
true.
That, like, whose fault is that, buddy? You had two espressos. You're walking around all day. Why don't you get a goddamn sandwich?
Exactly. This is New York. Get a pizza, motherfucker. So I'm acting like an asshole.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, man.
And I don't want to bring my personal life too much into it. I live with an artist right now.
Yeah, I was going to ask you like if like you can relate to this in any way because of Sarah.
The thing about that is that Sarah did not come out, you know, go to school to be an artist. She didn't come around to it for reals until our mid 30s, maybe our early 30s. And so she doesn't really have the whole, like, the things I was seeing with him where it's like, oh, I really have to be focused on my work 24/7 or else like that. Like, she understands how to function as an adult, things like that. And, like, I am the one who pays for most things, but she is aware that, like, we have to be adults about it and pay for everything. You know, I don't have any sort of high-paying job, so she does make money by, you know, doing nannying and stuff like that, but she is also pretty much full-time artist. So, like, I could see some things in there, but, like, it was more familiar to the things that I thought were spot on were when he was talking with Carlos, I think his mentor's name is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And being like, oh, man, I just wish I could, you know, he does that, like, kind of half, it's kind of a backhanded compliment, like, you draw like a child, I wish I could do that, like, oh, come on, man. Like, but I know people who have said that specifically to Sarah, because she'll do things that people are like, wait, how did you even do that? Because she doesn't have, she's not following a rule, she's just following her instinct. So that part, yeah, some of it was familiar.
Oh, okay.
Also, she was dancing with some guy, and I was like, "Hey, I want to dance with her." No, wait, no, never mind.
don't compare yourself to him.
I've been in education for a long time, and there are sometimes these like students who kind of like latch on to you, and it'll sometimes be the people who are like you least expect. Like she says, you know, like. She's always like, she's surprised why he's taking her class. Mm-hmm. And they never kind of explicit, at least I don't remember an explicit reasoning he gives, but he's just very drawn to her. So maybe, and I think the whole thing with like the lens that he has, maybe he, meaning he can see deeper within her. So the kind of idea of like the filmmaker being able to see beyond the surface. So maybe he sees the depth in her, and he's this insightful person. You know, that's kind of what I got from, especially when they're shooting the actual film, which is supposed to be this kind of abstract piece, but it, you know, it mirrors her existence in these weird ways, as far as, you know, the other woman with another man and the dancing and all that stuff. And it's like, okay, this is interesting. So he can peek into her existence. Also, the fact that it's about like the tragic mulatto, which I found very interesting.
Yeah, and I think her mother brings up the tragic mulatto, or Bill Gunn brings it up at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, Bill Gunn says something that's like a tale that her mother used to say or something, you know, that she used to talk about. I can't remember now. I'm losing my train of thought on that part. But I know it's a part of her, so it's interesting that like these things mirror her existence.
And like, I guess like another double would be in the movie that she's making. She's partnered up with Dwayne Jones, and in real life she was partnered with Dwayne Jones. So like, there's a lot of like doubling and mirroring.
Yeah,
doubling, but you know what I mean. Like the fiction and reality tie into each other.
Yeah.
Well, what'd you guys think of Dwayne Jones' character? And yeah, I don't mean like I think he's great, but in the beginning, I was kind of like, hey, what's this creepo? He's walking to me in the library.
Well, I laughed all through that scene when does she ask him, like, who are you? And he says, like, in one life I was an Italian count and I was in English. I was like, who is this weird he has like a little cape on.
I think he's wearing a hat too.
Yeah, aren't those the people you avoid in New York? I don't.
But sometimes you can't avoid them. You're in the middle of a library and they just come upon you and you're like, fuck, man, like I'm gonna have to talk to this person. Right. You know. But I think he was also, because he was so interested, he immediately is interested in what she's doing, which I think maybe that gets her kind of excited, even though he's really weird and eccentric.
Yeah. Do you take that as maybe that was acting roles? Because he was like an out-of-work actor?
Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I totally took that. I was like, when you find out he's an actor later, you go, oh, okay, that makes sense.
And like, he also, like, I guess he was a philosophy major because he knows all about like philosophy and the history of religion.
Yeah. Well, you know, but then as a theater actor, like, you know, Janae is big in the theater. So that's an interesting kind of. Yeah, Jean Genet, you know, The Blacks, and what's Genet's other big play? The Blacks is one of them, and The Maids, The Balcony, you know, he's a, and of like experimental, kind of absurdist kind of drama. So it would be, it would make sense with this kind of eccentric person would be up on Genet, you know, and they could have that kind of conversation. And I think that's a kind of an expectation of old theater people of that era. You know, they were really versed in those kinds of things, you know, Artaud and these different kinds of philosophical people. Theater people now don't really get into stuff like that anymore.
No. But, I don't know, I like that, he's a good counterbalance. Dwayne Jones is a good counterbalance to Bill Gunn. And also it's kind of, interesting to point out, you know, they were in Gunja and Hess together, so it's like that's the immediate connection of like if you know Gunja and Hess, and it's like, oh hey, this will at least be pretty interesting if they aren't screened together, and I don't know, like,
oh, Bill Gunn takes his clothes off in this movie too. Is that the comparison you're making?
he's shirtless. We can see shirtless Bill Gunn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he likes to show off them abs.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's no dunking his toothbrush in dirty bath water. Like this is not the Gunja and Hess episode, but goddamn, that moment is so fucking gross to me.
Oh yeah, totally.
Listen, he was he was on a mental thing going on there. Okay, you do crazy things.
Yeah, I mean, Bill Gunn's good at playing kind of unlikable, offbeat characters. It seems in like the two film roles I've seen him in, he's there's something that's unstable and not likable about him, but that also makes him so interesting to watch on screen.
Yeah, I mean, those are the kind of actors I like. They always said, you know, when I was acting a lot, like, you were like actors who have a sense of danger, like anything can happen at any moment, you know. Yeah. So he's unpredictable, you know, but it's never like you're able to kind of sit with it, but you also know that any moment you could like totally be shocked about what he's gonna do.
Yeah. So Joel, did you like Dwayne Jones in this? Like, I would like more of him in it, but I also understand, you know, it's more of him would offset like the whole overall balance of everything.
Right. Yeah. No, I think he's great in the movie. I think they got just the right amount, because the movie's not about him. It's about these two characters, and they do a great job of focusing in, especially on, is it Sarah?
Yeah.
Sarah mm-hmm. Scott, yeah, especially her character is slightly more of a focus than Bill Gunn. And when we see her getting closer to Duke in the movie, it feels natural, and they both play it that way. It's really good, and he does an amazing job. He's a good dancer when he wants to.
Yeah, he seems to be like a seems to actually give a shit about like the things she cares about, as opposed to her husband. And like, he's the generic tall, dark, handsome motif, which does come up in the movie with the psychic.
Oh yeah.
Except, I mean, was he wearing a top hat? See,
yeah,
I think that was a mistake.
Yeah, because like the psychic does say, like, oh, there'll be a Tartar cancer man in a top hat, and then like a couple scenes later, it's like, oh, he just shows up at the film shoot.
Shows up, right? Yeah, and I think that's like another adding a thing to the film of these, like, you know, premonitions and reads and double meanings and all that. It's so funny, you know, that she like dribbles them all in the film. Yeah, yeah, I really like Dwayne Jones in the movie. Go ahead. I'm sorry. You can go ahead.
Oh, sorry. No. I was just gonna say, I like how that lady was like, she was like basically asking her, like, how does it feel when you like to like physically or emotionally when you make these predictions? The lady's just like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, come on, lady, give me an inch.
Oh man.
Yeah. So So in Tume, you've made films before.
Whoa, 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 what?
He's a filmmaker, Joel.
Wow, this just is shocking news.
Yeah. Yeah, when the film student is like filming the like the overhead shot or whatever, like, is she making fun of like film students there, or is it just like, or this is, or like a realistic look? Like, I don't know, is this what it's like to shoot like your student film?
Oh, I think she's totally taking a little stab at like the naive, super into themselves. You know, we're going to lose the light, so we have to make sure we get the shot in right now, and we're going to dolly this, and look how that light is coming through. I think she's totally taking a piss at it. But like, I think in a loving way, though. Not in a, look how annoying these people are, but kind of showing what I experience is like the kind of the beauty of that kind of naivete when you're just really into what you're passionate about. And which is like a contrast of like someone, say, like Bill Gunn, who was like a late career artist. And he's so disjointed, you know, he doesn't have any real loving passion for art anymore. He's using it as a manipulative tool to get what he wants. While this young guy is just, you know, he's just in it, man. He's like, yeah. And he sees all this beauty in it. And so I think it's a nice poke.
Oh, okay. Cause like a lot of this movie, there's some stuff that, from like life experience and lack of educational experience, like some stuff just kind of went over my head, and I was like, yeah, I guess this is accurate, or I'm making fun of it. Just I don't know the whole details, and like with the I guess we can get into Bill Gunn's character a little more, but I like that early on, like he's telling Sarah that like, oh, I don't draw people, I do abstract art. That's only pure art. And then he, you know, meets another woman, and like immediately goes, oh, now I'm doing people again. And so it's like not even comment. I guess it's commented on a little bit afterwards, but this shows like he's completely full of shit and just so. I guess not necessarily that, but like this shows his flakiness, and it's like his childlike, like his childlikeness of like, oh, this is a new thing I'm interested in.
Yeah, totally. I agree 100%. Like, his interests. Yeah, I agree. I don't have anything good to add to that. I agree with you.
I mean, you look at this like an aspect of him coming to a more self-destructive point there. You know, like he's finally, in his mind, made a move in success where he feels like he's actually made it, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, we're in this house, I'm going to be even more, like, I can't decide what I want to do. And I don't know. There's the kind of people who feel like they don't deserve success, and so they will immediately try to sabotage it, like with subconsciously kind of thing. Like, if I wanted to read in the character, I could do that.
Yeah.
I mean, he does seem like a jackass from the beginning, so I don't know.
I feel like you're getting. Go ahead.
Like going to like his abusive behavior, like you see it played out a little, like much more. More graphically with Celia. Celia? Celia is the right way to say it. But like with her, because like, when they first meet, he's this, you know, he's very charming, he likes to dance, but then I think their first session that you actually see, she has this music blasting and he's screaming at her, and it's like, oh, this is what he's really like.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is like there's a you know, with Celia, there's like a kind of like a child, almost, you know, a young, I don't want to say childlike, but maybe a childlike nature to her also. So it's interesting because like it's, then he has to try to kind of like be assertive and almost adult-like to her. Get up! Why are you on the ground? And it's kind of weird. You know, this person who's like kind of like with his wife, he's kind of a child, you know, now that he has this other person that he's trying to control. Almost feels like a weird Picasso kind of thing, you know, where like Picasso would have his women and you know, try to like, you know, manipulate and dominate them.
Right. Yeah. That's pretty spot on right there. Like he's trying to go for that. Like, I'm controlling, I'm the artist. Like, I have my passions and I don't have to explain myself kind of thing. Yeah. And the first person who's fighting back, I think her actually giving some push to his shove is, actually gets him more interested, but he doesn't realize that she is quickly not amused by it anymore.
Well, like the scene of the dancing when she's dancing with, what was it? Carlos is his friend's name, right? When she's dancing with Carlos, and he tries to butt it, and she's like, no, man. And she keeps saying man, and I think the man thing actually is really hilarious. No, man. Like, I want to dance. And she just goes and dances by herself or dances with Dwayne Jones. Like, she has these clear boundaries, you know, like, uh-uh, I'm not doing that. And she's like, stop using me. You know, so she's very clear. And like you said, though, he actually likes it. He likes the fight, which is probably what he's not getting from his wife, which is makes it all twisted.
Yeah. What am I looking for? Like, he seems, even though he likes the fight, he doesn't like the realities of it, it seems, because there's the whole thing of, like, once he sees her with Carlos, he immediately is like, oh, I'm going to get replaced, and starts to get real offensive. And once he sees Dwayne Jones for the first time, like, he seems to realize this is what I must feel like for her. And then he, instead of being passive like she typically was, he fights back, but in a very unhealthy, toxic way, and was probably like, you know, the you can't dance moment, which is probably one of the most hurtful moments in the whole movie, because he drops to like the facade of trying to be playful and like hide it. It's like he just outright expresses his, you know, his feelings for his wife.
Yeah. And also his high levels of hypocrisy, because, you know, he's up here gallivanting with this woman, and, you know, his wife has just kind of accepted it, and then she just brings home this other man with her, and immediately he's like, how dare you? How dare you do this? And it's like, bro, you've been gallivanting around this whole thing with this young woman, and suddenly a guy comes with her, and you're just like, giving him the evil eye? Like, bruh, come on, man. How could you be more of a hypocrite?
I mean, the thing about that scene that's interesting to me, just the ending dance part there, is the fact that we have seen her dancing, you know, for this film like that. And she's got rhythm. She likes to do it. You know, she seems to enjoy it. And the moment where we almost think like he's going to notice maybe that, like, oh, she's actually trying to participate. This is different for her. He's so into himself. He can't, he already has his move planned out. You know, this is chess for him, where it's like, oh, okay, I'm going to try to make her jealous by bringing out my wife, you know, like, and I already know she can't dance. So we're just going to try to do a step here, and I'm not even going to give her a chance. And, I wanted to be like, yell at the screen, be like, hey, Sarah, go over there, grab Dwayne Jones and show him, like, oh, you think I can't dance? Boom.
Yeah, exactly. We've been dancing for the past few weeks doing this movie.
I know what I'm doing.
And that, of course, goes into the whole pool sequence where he, you know, assaults Celia, and that's the final straw. And yeah, that is so intensely uncomfortable. Like, it's not,
oh, yeah.
It's not like the worst thing I've ever seen in a movie, but like the way it's staged, and the way it's and where it's placed in within this movie, it just makes it so like so effective and deeply, deeply uncomfortable.
Well, so much lead up to it too. Like the film does a great job of kind of building up to this happening, you know, and there's so much tension, so that when that happens, like, you know, you just know he gets on top of her, you're like, oh, dude, come on, your wife's gonna walk in, bro, come on, man. And like, you're just like, ah. And then, because I think also because, you know, Sarette's character doesn't really blow up, she does right there, you don't see it in the movie until that moment. It's like, it's a big thing, and it's good that I think Kathleen Collins like practice a lot of restraint with, like, you know, their interactions, so she could really earn that moment at the end of, you know, this real big power moment, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, when that thing is happening, you already have seen that what is her character's name? Celia. Celia, you know. Mm-hmm. She already got a, you know, they were swimming in the pool early morning, they're freezing. She was already freezing, and she's over it already. Like, you can see this. And yeah, for some reason, you just can't follow what Bill Gunn is thinking. Like, how does he think it's going to be okay? Like, this has to be, like, the most destructive moment. Like, he needs somebody else to be in the action with him to hurt his wife as most, you know, best as he can. And when he gets to Celia trying to climb on her sleeping bag over, or he says it's his sleeping bag, but whatever, who cares, over and over again, it's like, you don't understand. You don't have a collaborator in this action, and you are just coming off as the biggest piece of shit. And it's actually, yeah, like you were saying, Spencer, it's kind of hard to watch.
Like, I think she smartly juxtaposes that with, like, right before, everyone is jumping in a pool having a good time, which makes it even more effective.
Yeah.
But before that scene, a moment I forgot to bring up is when they're filming, and I think she's talking about her husband with Dwayne Jones, and they're walking next to, like, the garden, and, like, the student asks, can you guys really kiss? Like, actually make it for real? And, like, she does with zero issues.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they were waiting for that.
They were like, permission to do this? Thank you.
Yeah, it's for the movie.
Yeah, like, yeah. That seemingly is the first time she ever stepped out on him.
Yeah,
right.
I love their little comment of, like, what's this movie about? And I think one of them says, I don't know.
And you know what? They say that an emotional affair is much, much worse than a sexual affair. So when you think about it, she's doing the worst. No, I'm just kidding. I just, you know, whenever things happen like these in movies, I can't help but try to, the advantage of having a lady director is that this movie contains almost zero female gaze thing. And the one time you do have, male gaze thing. Mm-hmm. Sorry. The one time you do have a kind of a male gazy moment, I think, you get it a bunch when Bill Gunn is walking around because he's checking out the ladies. And there's one blatant moment when the student film is going on and the rival to Sarah in the movie is she steps in front of the camera, you know, butt first kind of thing, like, aha, I'm here to stop you. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Of course he would shoot that. And yeah. It plays so well that way. It's I really like that part too.
Yeah.
Where am I going with this? So, I think, during the blow up, she has a line, your dick ain't a paintbrush. Which, like,
right,
which,
that's the line.
Which, like,
a great line.
It throws, like, all the subtext, and it's like, oh no, this is the text the whole time. like this is like his. He thinks that, you know, he can just do what he wants, but I just love the final moment is you see his face reacting to when she kills Dwayne Jones in the movie.
Yeah, he runs up to see her, which I think is actually at City College where they shot that. For New York people, they'll know what that is.
I have a friend who works there.
Yeah, I think it's. I'm almost positive it's City College campus. I'm actually sure it is.
Yeah, that's where Kathleen Collins taught. So,
oh, perfect. Then that is City College campus. He runs up to kind of see her, and then he intercepts her with the gun and shooting Dwayne Jones' character as he's dancing with the other woman. Bill Gunn, meaning we see him.
And Bill Gunn screams out loud, symbolism! No, he doesn't.
Well, but you know, it's funny you make that joke, because, like, the film, like, definitely has, like, its symbolic moments, but it doesn't scream them a lot, which I like.
Yeah.
That's what I really like about, kind of like we were saying about the kiss, right? We didn't get the big music, you know, like, they're finally gonna kiss. No, they're gonna kiss.
Right.
Ooh, okay. And it's just, things are just kind of complicated and okay. And that's what I appreciated about the movie. You know, I was like, okay, they're not overdoing these things. Which then when they do their weird quirky things, it works. Because it feels, they're not constantly overplaying their hand.
Mm.
Yeah. So, yeah, we kind of cover everything. If you're listening to this and you haven't seen Losing Ground, well, you really should. It's really remarkable for a first feature film. And this is, you know, buy a DVD. You get both of the films she made, including a short film, The Cruz Brothers, which I think is 45 minutes or 50 minutes long.
Yeah, it's about that long.
Yeah, so
yeah, I'd say it's a worthy blind buy if you don't really know anything about it, like, and you're worried about wasting money. Like, you're not going to go ahead and buy the Blu-ray, buy the DVD. It's definitely worth it.
Yeah.
And I tell people, and for reader people, like, honestly, like, if you like the film, I encourage to, like, read her short story book too. Like, they're really good stories. Like, I really, really got into them. And I actually bought, there's another collection of hers that just came out that I bought, and it actually has the Losing Ground screenplay, which I'm actually curious to read.
Yeah, a podcast I listened to, Her Head in the Films, covered this maybe last year. It's an older episode, but it is a good episode worth listening to. Okay. I think the host of that, Caitlin, listens to this, but I'm not sure.
Oh, cool.
But, where do I go with this? I don't think we brought this up, but I think this is at least, like, one of the first American films directed by a black woman.
So the thing that I read said it was the first since, like, the 20s or something like that.
Yeah, that's what I read, too.
Because didn't Zora, I don't get her name wrong.
Zora Neale Hurston?
Yes, didn't she direct some stuff, like shorts or something?
I think so, which then would make the 20s make sense. Mm-hmm. If that's the last time. Because she wrote in the 20s. Yeah, that was like her era, the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, but so yeah, this is kind of, unfortunately, a landmark film, even though it really shouldn't be.
The quality's so good. I'm so surprised that it's funny. A friend of mine, she told me. Well, she knew Sarette Scott was her teacher, the lead woman. She taught her, I think, acting. And she told me that, like, she once watched a VHS tape of Losing Ground in, like, the mid-2000s, you know? Hmm. And she was one of the only ones who had a copy of it. And I'm shocked. Because it's funny. When I heard it was so gone, I thought I would find something that was much less polished of a film. I thought it would have been something that's, like, you know, a little raggedy, maybe, that didn't have a lot. But I saw this, like, this is a really well-done, excellent film. Like, this didn't come out at all? What the hell? But, you know, well, yeah, it's not it shouldn't be surprising to me, sadly.
When I say this shouldn't be a landmark film, I mean that it's, like, one of the few, like, one of the first films directed by a black woman. Because that kind of is that
should have been that much space in between feature length. Yeah,
it's kind of, and because the next one was, I believe, Daughters of the Dust, which we also covered, which is real. Like, why did it take this fucking long to have black women direct movies? I mean, I know the answer, but still, like, this, why? I don't understand. Like, I don't know. That's just me being naive, but it's just ridiculous that, you know, that sector of people weren't given a chance, for so long.
Yeah. Knowing and understanding the answer to that question doesn't give knowing understanding is not an explanation. Like, there's right. Like, we need an excuse. No, we don't need an excuse. Like, well, somebody needs to be held accountable, and I guess it's society.
Yeah. It's not emotionally satisfying. It's like,
right.
I still don't feel good. Like, and I'm never going to feel good that this was a reality. It took this long.
Yeah. So, on that note, you know, we all recommend this movie because it's, you know, really good. And fortunately, she didn't get to make another one. So, So 1982 also produced some other films. And I think we should let the guest go first.
Okay. Let's see. Ashes and Embers. We mentioned L.A. Rebellion. So Ashes and Embers came out that year by Holly Garima, which I find, like, very interesting.
I have Bush Mama. I haven't watched it yet.
But. Yeah, I like Bush Mama. Ashes and Embers might be my favorite film by him, though. Not even might be. It is. And Ashes and Embers, I like to think that there were these two kind of, like, black movements happening. Sam Fuller's White Dog came out in 1982 as well.
Didn't that have a weird release, too? Like, it didn't... come out?
It came out in France and stuff like that, and that's about it. It never, I don't think it's ever had an official U.S. release. But you know, that became a cult movie that I found on VHS, and like I saw it in like '99, like, from Kim's Video.
Hmm. Oh, I'm familiar with Kim's. I've heard Marcus's recent episodes of Wrong Reel talking about who used to work there.
Oh, I haven't heard it yet, so I don't know.
Alec Ross Perry used to work there.
Wow.
And I think it's the New York Film Festival episode. He and Rob Cotto go in deep talking shit on when Ross Perry used to work there.
Oh, shit. I have to listen to that, but I haven't done that yet. Two others. One is one of my childhood favorites, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Which is like, I could still watch that all the time. And Veronica Voss by Fassbender came out that year as well. 82.
That's one of his last movies, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like one of the last, I think, two or three.
Hmm. All right. Joel, you got some?
Oh, you want me to go now? Okay. Well, yeah. Geez. I mean, two of my favorite movies of all time came out in 82, Blade Runner. Yeah. I don't think I have to talk about that one. And The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah.
Which is an amazing piece of filmmaking that happens to be a horror movie. And, you know, if you're one of those people that doesn't watch horror movies because you only watch the higher brow stuff, first of all, take that attitude, shove it up your butt. second of all, put on The Thing right now, because you know what? It's solid filmmaking. It's great storytelling, good acting, amazing creature effects, of course.
Yeah, like objectively, I would say that's Carpenter's best movie.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. Whatchamacallit?
Keyword is objectively. Personally, my favorite is Escape from New York. But that was the first one I saw of him. So that's kind of why I have a special attachment. But The Thing is just, like, filmmaking-wise, like, kind of the best thing he's done.
Which, right, yeah.
Yeah. I would agree. I think The Thing, I mean, Halloween sometimes feels that way also, but The Thing, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember. What's the Roddy Piper one I was just talking about?
Oh,
They Live.
They Live, yes. That's why I can never remember the title. It's like, what does that have to do with anything? But yeah, that's definitely my favorite. As for movies that we covered on Please Don't Send Me in Outer Space, 82, saw The Sword and the Sorcerer, which is a ridiculously amazing movie. I don't want to describe it. Just look up the trailer for The Sword and the Sorcerer, okay? And then go watch the movie. You're going to like it.
It's a good episode.
Mm-hmm. 1990, The Bronx Warriors, which is a Italian ripoff of, you know, all those, speaking of escaping from New York right there, that kind of stuff like that. It's pretty bad.
Oh, that's the one with Trash.
Yeah. It's got Fred Williamson in it.
Oh, yeah. He's always good.
Yeah.
Unless he's, you know, current Fred Williamson talking about politics, and it's like, ugh, shut up.
Yeah, acting-wise.
Yeah, acting-wise.
I appreciate seeing him. And Time Walker. Apparently we only watched crap in 82.
You haven't Time Walker episode?
No, we haven't. No, we were saving the bigger movies for, you know, people that might want to guest on The Thing, and then we never have guests, so that's our fault. But yeah, Time Walker is a movie that is almost an hour and a half long, kind of horror movie that manages to leave you on a cliffhanger that is never going to be fulfilled. And I wouldn't necessarily say it's worth watching unless you're hanging out with a bunch of friends. Then it'll be fun to make fun of, at least.
Oh, okay. For me, it's Cue the Winged Serpent. It's I've heard about it for a long time, and then I finally decided to watch it, and I realized, I mean, I sure have seen this like 10 years ago. This is a really good, interesting movie. And it's...
Yo, I just watched that movie like 2 weeks ago. I'd never seen it before. I'd never even heard of it. I watched it 2 weeks ago. Crazy movie.
Yeah, it's like an American, I guess, kaiju movie, sort of. But it's like, it's Larry... I don't say Fessenden, but that sounds right. Larry Cohen.
Cohen?
Yeah, so mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's smart and it's also entertaining. But it's on Shudder right now. And there's a Joe Bob episode on Q also. What else? First Blood, which is a literally great action movie, and it's a really good movie overall. And it's you know, it's similar enough to the sequels, but when you go from First Blood to like to second Rambo movie, it's like, oh, they decided to make this really stupid now. But this is like a, like Stallone does a real performance and is like a good story, and it's like, you know, it's, I feel like it's forgotten and thought of in the wrong way, even though the end credits song is goofy and kind of a strange choice, but everything else is, you know, it's definitely worth watching. And what was the other one? I had some
Swamp Thing.
Oh, yeah, Swamp Thing. I have a weird affinity for that movie, not for the Adrian Barbeau scene. Cause
don't lie.
Well, I was 15 when saw it, so partially. But also, it's just kind of this weird movie where it's like, Wes Craven made this? This is just a strange choice, and Swamp Thing is probably my favorite DC character. I've read the Alan Moore run, and after reading that and watching the movie, it's like, okay, this is kind of like the closest. Well, I guess this is a new series on that service, but like for a while, like this is like the only way you could really do it. And Wes Craven, when he's, you know, firing on all cylinders, is really good, entertaining, and insightful. And this is kind of like a good Wes Craven.
I mean, it's a totally enjoyable, fun movie. Yeah, like I don't think it's stellar or anything like that.
No, it's not his best, but still, like, okay, only he could have done, like, justice to this, because, like, it's such a weird, odd premise.
And give me a John Carpenter Swamp Thing.
Yo, that would have been crazy. But especially back then.
Oh, yeah. Amazing. Practical effects and Kurt Russell.
Now, would he play Swamp Thing?
No, he'd play Adrian Barbeau.
Okay. No, Adrian Barbeau will still be in it, because I think they're still married.
I'll be bathing myself. Don't you watch me, Swamp Thing.
So that's it. And Tume, thank you for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a great time once again.
Yeah, so do you have any updates on the movie you're starting soon-ish?
I'm in pre-production in like 2 weeks, so yeah, it's about to start. So we're getting it together. That's the update.
Is it a feature length or a short film?
Yeah, it's a feature length film. Yeah, so I'm about to the next few years of my life are going to be consumed with this. So I'm already in it, but I'm getting emotionally ready for not being able to turn back.
Ooh. That seems pretty exciting. So Joel, what do you have coming up?
Same old, same old. Episode of Mute's going to drop any minute now. Like literally, I set it up for releasing today on the July 1st, which is, I know the episode that we're recording right now is not going to be released today, but yeah. Since I get the next pick, I chose Alien 3, which I think gets hated on a lot, and I don't get it. Like, I really like Alien 3. Compare it to Aliens and Alien. That's a really hard standard to hold up to, but I still think it's a very solid movie. So we're going to talk about that coming soon.
I'm with you. I watched it 2 weeks ago, and I was like, you know what? This movie gets a bad rap.
Yeah. It's real good. I mean, Sigourney's really good in it. The creature effects. I mean, yeah. The things you like.
So, for me, for my site, Jailhouse701, Japanese Cult Cinema, I'm doing the Legends of the Poisonous Seductress series, which is kind of like the seen as like the proto Pinky Violence movies that kind of that helped spark the movement in the 70s. And there'll be kind of random scattered things besides those coming up. And I won't really. And yeah, in November, I'll kind of slow down the site because I'm starting another regular-ish like site slash project. So I'll give updates on that as it goes along.
Dope.
Yeah. So the next special episode for July. So July will get, I guess, four episodes instead of three. Will be Cotton Comes to Harlem with Chris Funderburg. And yeah, so we're gonna talk about the movie and the book a bit. So
dope.
Yeah. So Joel, the book is pretty short and, you know, easy fast read.
Yeah, you're assuming I know how to read. I don't
All right. So with that, see you guys next time.
Yeah, bye.
Bye-bye.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell, and thank you for listening.